Yeah, so I picked Jeremiah 29 because I've been doing my meditations in Jeremiah. And you know, Jeremiah 21, verse 11, "For I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for welfare and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope." It's such a powerful verse, such a powerful promise. But when I read it, it just made me stop and think, because I remember, you know, when I first read this, I don't know when, but, you know, that's the verse that sticks out, right? Chapter 29, verse 11, "For I know the plans I have for you." That's the verse that just sticks out. And then I realized I hadn't really considered the context of it. And what setting is God saying? What setting is that God giving this incredible promise? And one of the most comforting truths for a Christian is that, you know, it's that God is sovereign, right? It's this assurance that God is in control, and he's not just anyone, but a God who is gracious, loving, powerful, wise, whom through, you know, the work of Jesus Christ on the cross we can call Father. And we have this privilege, this amazing, incomprehensible right to call Father. It's this assurance that God, who is in control, is working for our good and everything. But then, yeah, to realize, you know, in what setting is God giving this verse? Bible Gateway recently published some statistics on their searches on their website for the past year, 2014. About 1.5 billion views, right? 1.5 different billion views on his website in the past year. And the most searched verse was John 3:16. It's not surprising. But what was surprising to me was that the second most searched verse on Bible Gateway for 2014 was Jeremiah 29, verse 11. "For I know the plans I have for you." It was the NIV version. "You know, I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope." It was kind of interesting to me, kind of because, you know, it's an Old Testament passage. I would think general public would not be aware. But it's also not that interesting because it's not just Christians who want this kind of comfort and assurance in their lives. It's not just Christians who use Bible Gateway. But it did make me wonder also, you know, do these visitors to Bible Gateway understand this verse in its context? And so I went kind of more deeper into the details, like what else are they reading in Jeremiah 29, but it's really only this one verse, verse 11, and a little smidgen of verse 13. Verse 13, "You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart." But it's really just this verse, the second most searched verse in 2014. So my point in bringing this up is that, you know, it just seems human nature, it seems very obvious that people want this security. It's human nature because we were made to receive this security from elsewhere. That's the message of the Bible, that we were made to receive this from God. But it's also human nature to, you know, bend and twist and try to manipulate what God has given, manipulate God himself according to our will and desires. You know, people want to seize this. They want to appropriate it for themselves, the promises of God, to make it convenient, you know, conform to their own will, their own desire. And they, sometimes we, you know, we want all the benefits of God, but not the commands or the inconvenient truths. And this also is, you know, human nature, right, because of sin. But again, the fact remains that this is an amazingly good truth, right? This truth is meant to give us hope, comfort, and assurance. And God declared to the Jews in the exiles, you know, his plans for them, for the good and not evil. And this declaration also stands in a real way for Christians today. But yeah, it made me want to understand the context, the circumstances in which God gives it, if we are to properly apply it into our lives and our situations. So one way I thought to look at the passage is to ask the question, how do my plans line up with God's plans? Now, the historical context that we see in Jeremiah 29 is that a preliminary exile has taken place. That's what we see in verse 2. King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, he took away King Jeconiah, some of the more important people, the officials, soldiers, craftsmen to Babylon. In 2 Kings, there's also a little more description also that only the poorest of the poor were left in the land. Tens of thousands of the important people, the leaders, the rich nobles, the strongest soldiers, the men of valor, as described in the king's family, they're taken into Babylon. And this preliminary exile was, up to that point in their history, the worst day in the history of Israel. Right, the worst day until the actual exile takes place and the city is ransacked and burned. But up to then, this was the worst day in the history of Israel. Their own king led away in captivity into a foreign land. Many of the most capable and wealthiest and educated, wisest people, the leaders, they're taken away. And you can imagine their shock and their sorrow, their despair. I was thinking, you know, it's like President Obama and all of Congress, like all helicopters from somewhere come by, take him all away. The generals and commanders of the army, the professors, the scientists, the CEOs of the major corporations and the wealthy, tens of thousands of the leaders and the most important people just taken away as captives to a foreign country. And I was just imagining their sense of loss and uncertainty. And what's going to happen to us? Probably thinking. But it's also in times of uncertainty and insecurity that people become very vulnerable to false prophets and false promises. They're so desperate for any kind of security, they'll grab onto anything. And that's what we also see in Israel at this time. False prophets, both in Israel and in Babylon, are declaring to the Jews that the exile would be over in 2 years, that God will be bringing back the king, Jeconiah, to Jerusalem to seat him on the throne. Everyone will be brought back, and the power of Babylon will be broken. And anticipation of this relatively immediate deliverance, and the people in exile, they're just waiting. You know, they're just living as if they were with Moses in the wilderness in tents, booths, until they were settled again in Israel. But God speaks to Jeremiah a letter to the exiles in Babylon to correct this deception. Verse 5. Build houses and live in them. Plant gardens and eat their produce. Take wives and have sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there and do not decrease. God tells them to settle down in Babylon because the false prophets are deceiving them. God has not sent them because it is God's plan that they remain in Babylon for 70 years. So this is the flow of logic in this passage. God's saying, you know, settle down. You're being deceived. Don't listen to him because you're going to be in Babylon for 70 years because this is my plan to give you peace. This is my plan to give you peace. The word being translated as welfare throughout this chapter, throughout this passage, is literally peace. Every time you see welfare, it's literally peace. And as we talked about, you know, it's not peace in the sense of stillness and tranquility or silence, but a peace that is full of life, wholeness, security, and even prosperity. Not meager, not just hanging on by the nails, but full life. Now, the irony here is that the people's understanding of peace and wholeness and security is going back to Israel, right? Their plans are to go back to Israel as soon as possible and settle right back at home, which is possible at this point because the cities are not destroyed. They can just go back and settle down. There's damage, but it's not destroyed. They can rebuild. It's not that bad. The temple is still there. The palaces are still there. The city wall is still there. Jerusalem is still there. And the plan of the people, you know, in their understanding of peace, well-being, is to go back to Israel as soon as possible. And that's the best thing that they see happening for them. But again, God's plan for their peace is letting them stay in Babylon for 70 years. And that's around the average lifespan of a person in the ancient world. You know, Moses saying man's years is 70, 80, if by strength. That's kind of what we see in ancient times, 60, 70 years, if you made it past childhood. Like 50% of children died before the age of 10. But if you got past 10 years old, you were likely to live 60, 70 years. And this promise that God gives them, right, it's beyond the average lifespan of a person in the ancient world. And God's good plan, right? God's plan for their peace, for his people, is for most of them to die in Babylon. But what we see as God explains this is that it's so that in the years of their captivity, they may call upon God, pray to him, seek him with all their heart to finally find him. This is God's plan for peace, future, and hope in their lives, that the exiles might find God in the midst of this great loss and this great uncertainty. And we see such mercy here, because the exile was punishment, right? The exile was punishment for their idolatry, their rejection of God, the oppression of the poor, the arrogance of the rich and the wealthy and the powerful. But in God's great wisdom and mercy, it's their means of salvation. And he's stripping away all these things, all the things that they held on to, all the things that they trusted, and he strips all this away, taking away all the sources of temptation and idolatry, so that there may be a chance for them to find true peace by seeking and finding God. Everything else that God promises, to restore their fortunes, to gather them together, to bring them back from the nations, it flows from this essential relationship of knowing and trusting God. And with God as the center of their hearts, then he will bless them with everything else. It will no longer be an idol, a hindrance for them of actually knowing and finding God. But again, this restoration of fortune and bringing them back from exile, it was outside the lifespan of most of these people. It just made me think, you know, why should they be motivated by something that they would never see with their own eyes in their own lifetime? Or why should they be motivated? Why should it mean anything to receive an earthly promise which they would never see with their own eyes in their own lifetime? But I think what the point of these promises is that it's pointing to the trustworthiness of God. It's pointing to God himself, that God will fulfill all that he has promised. See, these promises make sense if you know God. Even if you may not receive it in your lifetime, it makes sense if you know God. The promises of God are convicting and motivating, not because we're looking forward to get these things ultimately, but because we know the God who is promising them. Right? The promises of God, as I was thinking about it, as I understand it, the promises of God are expressions of God himself. The promises themselves are revelations of God himself, because we get to know more of who God is through his promises. We hope in them. It's not about the promise themselves. It's not getting the gift itself, or it's not getting the good things themselves. But in the promises themselves, we get to know who God is. And so ultimately, we're hoping in him. To hope in his promises, to wait for them, to live in response to them is ultimately hoping in him. I think this has been true for all believers throughout history. Like the author of Hebrews writes, you know, how the men of faith, they were commended for their faith, but they did not receive what they were promised. Yet they didn't waver in their faith. And in fact, the promises of God strengthened their faith. It made them realize that glory, that awesome goodness of God. David received promises about his kingdom and his throne lasting forever. He's not going to see this. He's not going to see this. He's going to die. He may see his son, but he's not going to see the fullness of all that God promised. But it just brought him to his knees, face down, in worship of God. Who am I? Right? Who am I to receive this? The promise of God just revealed that glory, the mercy, the abundant generosity, the steadfast love of God to David. And it increased, it deepened his worship of God. The promises of God strengthened his faith, gave a greater glimpse of who he is, and it urged them, right, to continue in the pursuit of God all the more. In our passage, the way the promises of God were to move and motivate the exiles was by creating in them a desire to seek the welfare, the peace of the Babylonians. So in verse 7, God gives this command, seek the welfare of the city where I've sent you into exile. Pray to the Lord on his behalf, for in its welfare, peace, you will find your welfare, your peace. And it's such a shocking command that God gives to the Jews in exile. Right? These are the very people who took Israel into captivity. These are the ones who are besieging the walls of Jerusalem, killing the people, causing them to suffer hunger, famine, disease. There was no bread at one point in Jerusalem because of the siege, and people were dying of hunger. And yet God is calling the Jews to seek their peace, their goodness, their well-being, their wholeness. And God is saying, as you seek their wholeness, you will find your wholeness, your security. It's even more ironic to me because God has already declared, he's already promised that yes, these Babylonians, they're going to destroy Jerusalem. They're going to take you into exile. But when that's done, I'm going to destroy them. I'm going to overthrow them. It's also ironic to me because God is telling the Jews to seek their goodness, but at the same time, God has already declared, but when time comes, I'm going to deal with them. He's going to overthrow them. But as I was thinking about it, you know, showing peace, showing goodwill to Babylon is such a perfect expression of faith. You know, we see like in Proverbs and you know, Paul quotes it in Romans 12, how, you know, do good to the wicked man, those who persecute you unjustly, and you will be pouring burning coals on their heads. It shows such faith and hope in the justice of God, because vengeance belongs to the Lord. God would judge the wicked. God would judge the wicked. You can trust that. You can bank on that. So you can be gracious. You can be generous to your enemies. You can forgive your enemies. Because you know that God in the end will do what is just. But I don't think that's what God has in mind here, though, judgment. I think what God is promising to the exiles is that he will give them such peace, right? Such abiding, abundant peace, that it will be, it must be, expressed to their neighbors and in the city in which they are exiled. They will receive such peace from the Lord that they are called to seek the peace of others. So I think this passage is, I guess logically, I would think, you know, you'll get the promise first. God is saying, I will give you peace so you seek their peace. But I think he's going the other way. He's giving the commands first to kind of, you know, make them stop and think. Why are we going to build cities here? Why should we seek their peace? And then God is saying, because you're going to be there 7 years. You're going to die. You're not going to see everything I promised. But I will give you peace. God is promising them abundant peace, that it will be overflowing. It must be expressed to their neighbors. And in seeking their peace, of those of their enemies, they will receive peace themselves, or they will find their peace. And here's a picture of salvation as I thought about it. It's just so consistent with the New Testament gospel of salvation in Jesus Christ. Even in the worst situation possible for the Jews, God commands them to seek and pray for the peace of their enemies. And the promise, the source, the foundation that supports this command, it comes later, but then there is that connection. God has plans for their peace of the exiles, and these plans will be fulfilled in finding and knowing God. So even in great loss and uncertainty, knowing God is able to give the Jews a peace that overflows into peace toward others. I think that's the picture of salvation, the life of faith for Christians too. We know peace. You know, we know peace, a transformed life of hope and joy in God through Jesus Christ that overflows in love and truth toward others. Now, one of the questions I asked earlier how we can look at this passage was, how do my plans line up with God's plans? Well, in looking over the passage, we see the two parts of God's plan that he has for his people. You seek God with all your heart, and then to seek the peace of others. Again, those two greatest commandments. You love the Lord with all your heart and love your neighbor as yourself. Again, the picture of salvation is consistent with the Old Testament. In response to knowing the peace of God, we seek the peace of others because we know that joyful fellowship of God himself. Again, they're not going to receive the promises ultimately, but knowing God himself, that joyful fellowship of God himself, they ultimately are to seek and share that joy with others. It's going to be expressed in joy in sharing with others. God's desires for the Jews in exile was that they would know him. The Jews, they had all the traditions. They celebrated the works of God in history. They had the covenant, the feasts, the temple rituals, the sacrifices, the scriptures. All these things that pointed to God, but they didn't know God. They didn't actually trust him. And as I reflected on my Christian walk recently, I kind of saw this, similar parallel, this tendency, of overlooking that relationship with God, taking that for granted. I mean, there are a lot of things I want to do in obedience to God, right? I want to love my wife better. I want to prepare for this winter retreat coming up. I want to love and serve the church more sincerely, faithfully. There are all these prayers in my mind and burdens on my heart. But even in the midst of what I think are good things, I'm losing this sight of worship, of fellowship, of being in the presence of God, of that joy of just knowing God. So my plans I've been wanting to do, to do. But I've been reminded of this first and great need to seek and know God. So I also want to encourage this, for you. And if you're finding yourself in this situation too, to regain this proper order and abiding peace that is expressed in peace to others. It's kind of one thing. How do my plans line up with the plans of God? What am I prioritizing? And yet, what is God's desire for me? But I think the full application of this passage, I think it's found in the midst of real disappointment and hardship. I think the full application and kind of main point of what God is speaking to encourage us in this passage is ultimately trusting in God when the things that you hope for, and they may have been good things, but the things that you hope for fall apart. We may be disappointed by circumstances, something that may happen to us, but we may be also disappointed by people we trusted or relied on, who have hurt and betrayed us. And I see two responses that we are often tempted by when faced with disappointment. I think one is we want to be more prepared. We want to be more competent. We want to be more ready to take immediate action to solve that problem or disappointment. And second, we close our hearts to people and to hope. We close our hearts to hope. We want to be ready for everything, self-reliant, and we don't want to expect anything from other people. I think that's a temptation. And if we do these two things, we'll never be disappointed. Or if something bad happens, we'll say, all right, I wasn't prepared, but I'll be prepared next time, and then I won't be disappointed. We'll think, or we'll fool ourselves in thinking we'll never be caught off guard. But you see what this happens, what this results in our lives, how it leads us, one, to depend on God less, and two, grow cold and unloving toward other people. I think that's a tendency as I was thinking about it. Be self-reliant on myself and not depend on God. And to not expect anything from people. and so, you know, grow in loving towards them. But as you see in the exile, you know, as we went through this historical context of this passage, it's through these disappointments and hardships that we are forced to recognize and let go of these idols, or, you know, these things that we hold on to in our lives. This is God's gracious and sovereign plan for our peace, our future, and our hope in Him, that He leads us through these disappointments. As we let go of idols, or, you know, we may recognize, finally recognize idols that we did not know we have, and we learn to depend on God more. And as we find more peace in depending on God more, our hearts are more filled with peace to share with others. So as I thought about disappointment and how God uses it in our lives for our sanctification, I also thought about shame, or, you know, painful experiences of the heart in general, negative, painful experiences of the heart that makes you or tempts you to react or respond in some way, whether in anger or closing your heart or busyness. It makes you respond in some way, tempted to respond in some way, but not necessarily come before God to seek God with all our hearts. And I was reminded of Psalm 25, the psalm that David wrote, saying, "Indeed, none who wait for you shall be put to shame." That's the first part. Second part, they shall be ashamed who are wantonly treacherous. Those who, again, do not trust God, but in their own wickedness, they act to oppress or deceive others. But, you know, indeed, none who wait for you. It is true. It will be, you know, none who wait for you shall be put to shame. None who wait and trust in God shall be put to shame. That's what David says. And I was thinking, you know, there is supposed to be a lot of shame in the Christian life. You know, taking up your cross, that's a life of shame. And Jesus telling us we would be hated and reviled by others because of Him. You know, shame. And David also, he knew a lot about shame. And chased by Saul, having to run and hide like a rat. He had to watch Saul poop. I was kind of thinking about that. It's probably shameful for both of them. But, you know, he's like hiding in a hole and he's watching this guy poop. That's shameful. You know, he's chased by his own son. He's mocked by the people he's trying to take care of, his own people, mocked by his own people, having to pretend to be crazy to save his own life. You know, shameful, shameful. But David says so boldly, he says so boldly that none who wait and trust in God shall be put to shame. And I think we can also add disappointed or frustrated, any of these things that makes us want to react in some kind of way, have a reaction to it. None who wait and trust in God shall be ashamed, disappointed, or frustrated in the end, because we have these promises. We know this God. We know this God. We may die without having received the promise, or, you know, like Abraham, having died not receiving his promises, but yet he had this faith in God through these promises. He was not disappointed in the end. And this is because in his life, David came to know God. David found Him. Right? The promises only increased his knowledge, his experience of God. I was also thinking about Paul and his shame. Persecuted, suffering much for the sake of the gospel. But in his shame and all his hardship, he came to boast in the power and the grace of God. And his own weakness. And in these men, we see that peace, that future, that hope that God has planned for them. And they are not wavering. They are not hindered or shaken, but it only deepens their dependence and their hope in what God has promised. That, you know, though shame and disappointment, you know, we will experience these things in life, you know, it's through these things that they gain the clearer glimpse of God. And so we're strengthened more in their pursuit of God, in doing His will, in seeking the peace of others. We sang "It Is Well With My Soul," the hymn. And I guess I don't know if you know the background. This guy wrote it, Spafford, wrote it in like 1850s. And he wrote it because he was sailing, he was on a boat crossing the Atlantic Ocean. And then he came to a spot where four of his daughters drowned while they were also traveling the same way. Four of his daughters drowned. Not only that, before his daughters drowned, he had a business in Chicago. But, you know, there was a great fire in Chicago in the 1800s. Most of the city burned, and he lost his business. He became poor. So in the short span of time, he lost his business. He lost his four daughters. And after his wife was rescued, you know, in that wreckage, she sends this really short telegram, "Saved alone," which became well known. That's all she said, "Saved alone." It's just me. But as he was, you know, sailing at this spot, you know, he sings this soul. I mean, he feels this in his soul, and he sings. "And when peace like a river attends my way, the peace of God." I can't remember the lyrics right now. "You know, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say, you know, it is well with my soul." He's not saying I'm holding on. He's not saying I just got the lid on this sorrow. I can just manage. But no, he's saying it is well. And I think he's preaching it to himself. I think that's why the refrain, he's just repeating, "It is well." He's not just preaching it, but he's also declaring, "It is well with my soul. It is well with my soul." And then he meditates on these other truths, what God has done. And after this message, we're going to sing the promises of what is yet to come. Right? He has these verses. "This is my God. This is what he has done. This is my blessed assurance. Christ has shed his blood for my soul. And my sin has been nailed on the cross. Praise the Lord, O my soul." So meditating on that was an encouragement. You know, we see this. People who know God, they know his peace. And it overflows to worship, a deeper knowledge of him, a hope in his promises that we have not yet received, and in love, and in seeking the peace of others. So I don't think I've experienced much shame or disappointment in my life. So I'm not saying I'm an expert in all these things. I talk about other people's lives, right? But this is a truth that we see in the Word. God in his wisdom and his grace toward us, he uses shame, disappointment, that we may be free from our meager plans or the idols that we may not have been aware of, but ultimately that we may grow in his peace, that fullness of hope and joy, and that we may be his peace towards others, ultimately to God's praise and worship, ultimately to God's glory. So I want to encourage you and to remind you, now let's continue to seek the Lord with all our heart, because he will hear us, because he has found us and we have found him. And as we abide in that peace, may we ask for grace to seek the peace of others. Let's pray.